I mean, I was asked to give a talk about anomalies. So my talk will be like just a very, I mean, this is a huge subject. And all I want to do is introduce or acquaint you again to the Quantum Foundations community, how anomalies, what are anomalies and how can they appear in quantum theory. So this talk is meant to be for non-experts. So I will start with something extremely elementary and simple that everyone knows. And the goal will be to introduce without too many technicalities what is an anomaly and what consequences anomalies have for physical systems. So the subject of anomalies starts with symmetries of a physical system. So if there is one topic that one cannot exaggerate enough about the importance that they have in physics, is the subject of symmetries. I mean, they really play a fundamental role in our understanding of physical systems. And we use them very strongly to solve interesting physical problems. So we're going to start, first of all, in the classical world. And as I said, I will start very, very elementary. So we're going to start by something very simple. So just understand what symmetries are and what consequences symmetries have for physical systems. So what I'll do, I'll start with just a non-relativistic particle moving in one dimension in some potential V of X, okay? So you can describe this system with some Lagrangian like this. So you have some kinetic energy and a potential energy Vx. And something that you can, and we assume that the potential only depends on the position of the particle. Something that you can essentially prove by inspection. Okay, so the first statement that we're going to use is that we're always going to use the action principle. I mean, it's not fundamental that we do that, but let's assume that. So to the Lagrangian of this particle, we can construct the action just by integrating over time the Lagrangian, okay? So what are the classical equations of motion of this system? You obtain just by extremizing the action, where you specify some variations at to initial and final time. And that gives you the equations of motion, which are something like that. Okay. So now, one thing that you can notice is that if you can define a quantity, E, which is 1/2 x dot squared plus V of x, which has the special property that is conserved. So such that dE dt equals 0. So let's check that. So indeed, that let's compute what dE dt is. It's just x dot x double dot. And now I take the time derivative of this, and I just use the chain rule, and you get that. So by the equations of motion, which I just wrote down there, this quantity is conserved, okay? So this is extremely useful when you solve a particle mechanics, because if you have such a situation, instead of solving some second order differential equation, you can use the fact that you have a conserved quantity, namely that's called the energy. You can use the fact that you have a conserved quantity, which is the energy, to essentially solve for the dynamics of the particle in the potential by quadrature. So solve by quadratures. So essentially just by stating that x dot, by integrating this equation, essentially, okay? So having a conserved quantity, namely the energy, is a very powerful way of solving for the dynamics of that theory, okay? And as we will see later, and more systematically, the reason that there is a conserved quantity is that you can check, and this will be the statement of another theorem later, that this action has a certain invariance, which means that if I vary the action by some transformation, delta x, which is epsilon x dot, where epsilon is some small parameter, the action is left invariant, okay? And we will see that there is a deep connection between invariances of the action and conserved quantities. And this transformation is just the obvious geometrical transformation that you get from time translations. Essentially, if you have, well, I think, is it obvious that this has to do with time translations? Okay, yeah. Okay, very good. So that's something very elementary. So we have an invariance of the action, and it just happens that we have a conserved quantity that I could construct. In this case, I could construct it by hand without noticing that this was a symmetry of the action. Now you could imagine a situation where you even have more symmetry. So you could imagine, just to show you how symmetries are really extremely powerful in solving that, in helping you unravel the dynamics of your system. So imagine now I consider a system that has a scale symmetry. So I think it's obvious, it's an obvious point that this will not happen for an arbitrary potential V of X. This will only happen for very special potentials of V of X. So that this is a bit more, I don't want to talk to myself for 1 hour, so I don't like hearing myself. So can someone tell me what kind of potential V of X will give rise to a scale symmetry to this particle moving on a potential? There is, okay, modulo, there's actually a unique answer. That's not quite true. In the quantum theory, it's not a unique answer, but in classical physics, it's a unique answer.
Zero. Can it be zero?
That's super not exciting. No, I mean, someone has to say something.
Whatever x squared.
More or less square, precisely. And if you go through your dimensional analysis, so you can define a coefficient alpha here, essentially the point is that this system, so the system 1/2 x dot square minus alpha over x square has no dimensionful parameter. So that means that this system is invariant of some scale transformation. So in particular, if I make a transformation of the type, so I have a function, some trajectory of a particle x of t, and I say that x of t so I rescale time in this way, so I send t to lambda t. So under rescaling, you can check, it's a simple exercise that the action is a scale invariant. In this language, we can now compute the infinitesimal form of the variation. So if I take now lambda to be a small transformation, so lambda equals 1 plus epsilon, so a transformation close to the identity, we'll derive from here that delta x is minus epsilon t x dot from here plus 1/2 epsilon x. Okay? And this action has the property, just like we had it for the transformation, say, for under time translations, that this dilatation transformation has the property that delta of x plus delta d of x equals s of x. OK? Now, this is much less clear, but even without knowing Noether's theorem, you could have, if you stir this for long enough, and you're okay, and you write the equations of motion. So again, the equations of motion of the system are just delta s equals zero, which implies that x double dot, the signs will run in loops, but I believe, something like that. Then you can check that the following quantity is also conserved. So I can define a slightly more obnoxious looking quantity, something like 1/2 x x dot minus t minus essentially the action, the Lagrangian. You can prove that dq dt is zero by using the equations of motion. OK? So it means that this system has two conserved quantities, because obviously we already knew that this system is invariant under time translations. So we have energy conserved, so we have two conserved quantities, which is going to be the energy and this cookie quantity Q. OK, and the point here, yeah, as I said, that it's conserved. And note that in this case, if you have more symmetry, essentially you have completely solved for the dynamics of the system. And if you give the two conserved charges of the system, you determine x as a function of E and Q by quadrature, because already from energy conservation you solve for x dot, and from this conservation equation you solve for x. So this is just the obvious statement that if you have more symmetry, you have more control of your dynamics. Okay. Good. And the key point is that we have these nice equations, these conserved charges, dq dt and dE dt. Okay. So of course, this can be generalized in many different ways. We can go to higher dimensions. So just a particle in a central potential. So say, in particular, for the Kepler problem. So we'll have, so now this is going to be a vector. Say we have a particle moving in three dimensions in some potential V of R, where R is x squared. Okay. So in this case, there's also a quantity that's conserved that's called angular momentum. And angular momentum, you can check very easily from the equations of motion. So again, you can write the equations of motion for this thing, that x dot tensor product with x is a conserved quantity. Okay. And again, this follows from the fact that the action has an invariance where delta x is some arbitrary vector cross x. Okay? That's just the rotation. So you have rotational symmetry, essentially. Okay, and this story, so here I presented non-relativistic examples because I thought this probably would be more familiar to this community, but there is nothing of what we've done here that's going to be generalized to theories with or systems with other space-time symmetries. Like relativistic field theories. So in particular, I could write down the action for, say, electromagnetism. Okay, if there's a symbol I write that's not clear, please ask me what it, so F mu nu is just the standard electromagnetic tensor that is defined in terms of the vector potential and it gives you the electric and magnetic fields. And you know, as usual, a Gates field can be coupled to charge fields. And something that we will care about later on more, and this I may have to digress on this, you tell me if I have to. You can couple it to fermions. So you have a fermion that carries a charge. I can, this charge couples to the Gates field, the corresponding Gates field. And you can write down a relativistic action that couples a charged fermion to the Gates field. So it will look something like this. So. Okay, and yeah. So these guys play an absolutely fundamental role in particle physics. Essentially, every elementary particle in the universe is a fermion. The only bosons are the exchange forces and the Higgs field. Okay. Now, should I explain this notation better, or people know what that, like, the Dirac equation is? Should I explain? Okay. So this system will have some symmetries, and we will discuss them extensively. In particular, we will look at certain symmetries that the fermions have. That will be one of the main examples of anomalous symmetries. Okay. Good. So this is just to say that this idea that systems have symmetries and conserve quantities does not care at all whether you're looking at one particle mechanics, field theory, whatever. It's very general. An important point about this is that the conserved charges, so you have a physical system and you list them, so you give labels QA, it goes from 1 to N, okay? So all of them are conserved. So this under the Poisson brackets, so we're still in the classical world, so under Poisson brackets, these guys generate a Lie algebra. So if I look at the Poisson bracket of QA, QB, you get something like that, okay? Where these guys are the structure constants of some Lie algebra G. Okay? So then we say that the system, so the bus, I mean, what we'll say is that the system has symmetry G, a symmetry group G. I'll be careless about groups and algebra, but anyway, symmetry algebra too, okay? Okay, so now I want to make a little bit more precise. So in these examples, it appeared a bit mysterious, but maybe not in the first one. This you could all have figured out. In fact, I think in high school, we are asked to figure out that using the equations of motion, the energy conserved. Here maybe, you need to be much more inspired. But the one of the central results in this subject that goes back to Noether. Gives you essentially for every, so this is essentially one way of saying Noether's theorem. It tells you that to every continuous symmetry of the action of your physical system. So we want to describe your degrees of freedom by some action. This captures the classical dynamics of your degrees of freedom. So the fact that it's a symmetry means that there exists a delta phi. So a certain transformation that acts on your, so I'm going to call phi. So phi will have many indices. Essentially, these are all the fields in the universe. So this is your degrees of freedom of your system. Okay. So exists a delta phi that is generated by a certain transformation. This could be a transformation that acts on space-time, or it could be a transformation that acts on some internal degrees of freedom, like isospin. that has the property. So that the symmetry of the action means that what we said before, that it leaves the action invariant. There exists, a conserved current. So I'm gonna phrase it in the more general case where I'm studying field theory. You want to restrict to one-dimensional particle mechanics, you just take some derivatives that are not there to zero, okay? There exists a conserved current. That obeys a conservation, a continuity equation, okay? So these guys will be the conserved current. Okay. And associated to these continuous transformations and to this conserved current, we can construct a conserved charge, time independent charge. Q, where essentially we take that, okay, so one thing that's important, so here, okay, so here already I'm using a lot of compact notation, so by d mu I mean d dx mu, and x mu is just a vector that includes time and space coordinates. If I'm in a relativistic setting, this is the natural notation. If it's non-relativistic, I can still use this compact notation, no problem. So essentially, if you integrate, so now, okay, to this conserved current that you can canonically construct given an invariance of the action, you can associate a conserved charge that you get by integrating over a fixed time slice the time component of the current. And then you can check by integrating by parts and using the conservation law that this quantity is conserved. It's time independent. Okay?
You mentioned this could apply to internal degrees of freedom.
Yes.
And so if you're applying to a discrete degree of freedom, in what sense is it a continuous symmetry? Wouldn't it be a discrete symmetry of that?
No, by continuous means that the group of transformations is continuous. So I mean, there are symmetries that can be discrete, like parity.
Okay, so you're not going to allow just spin flips. You're going to talk about rotations.
Yes. I allow those, but to discrete symmetries, there is no conserved current. You can still represent the symmetry. Okay, let's go to quantum mechanics. I mean, you can still. Also, there is a theorem by Wigner that says that every symmetry can be represented either by unitary or anti-unitary operator on the Hilbert space. So discrete symmetries are still realized on the Hilbert space by either unitary or anti-unitary operator. But if they're discrete, there's no associated conserved current with it. Like parity or charge conjugation and so on do not have a conserved current associated to it. But there is an operator that represents the symmetry on the Hilbert space. Like parity. What's nice about this theorem, about this, is that it removes all the guesswork in the sense that it gives you you can just compute from first principles what the conserved currents are. And the way you do it is the following. So you know that this guy is a symmetry. So how do you construct? J mu. So the way you construct is you say, OK, by fiat, this guy is a symmetry of the action. So now let me look at it instead of the following transformation. So I add this fictitious parameter epsilon, which is an arbitrary function of x. What do we know about what happens in this case? Well, what we know is that if epsilon were a constant, this would be a symmetry. Okay? So the failure for it to be a symmetry is measured by the derivative of epsilon. So this implies that this has to take the form dx du mu of epsilon times j mu. So this defines a vector, which will end up being the conserved current. OK? And now what's important about this is that if epsilon were a constant, this guy would be So what I want to say is that on the equations of motion are stationary with respect to an arbitrary variation. So delta S equals zero means that this is invariant, the action is invariant under arbitrary variation. So this implies that d mu, j mu vanishes on the equations of motion. So this procedure has given you a canonical way of constructing, given a transformation, a current that will be conserved from the equations of motion. I saw a hand.
Sorry. Do you have the right-hand side as S5 plus that integral?
Here?
And it's like S, so on the right-hand side, shouldn't you have S5 plus that?
Now, here, this is just the statement that if epsilon was constant, mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm looking at.
The right-hand side is change in action.
No, yeah, so here I should have, if I write it this way, I should have written like this, I think, yes. Yeah. Yes. All right, thank you. Okay, so this gives you, again, the conservation laws. So now we see a nice relationship between symmetries of the action and conservation laws, okay? So now we can go back and use this transformation and this transformation to indeed construct. So in this particle mechanics case, we only have time, right? So J is just Q, essentially, directly. So we can compute directly the Q. Just if this is a bit too abstract, let me give you a very simple example that will also highlight the fact that conserved charges under Poisson brackets generate a Lie algebra. OK, so let's consider something very simple. So a non-relativistic particle, so say in one dimension. And remember that the action is just dTdl. OK? So what is an arbitrary variation of the action? It's just x dot delta x dot. OK? So of course, this is a non-relativistic particle in one dimension, so it should be invariant under translations. So it should be invariant under delta x equals a. So now let's construct by Noether's procedure the current. So delta of s is just going to be x dot a dot. And this a, notice that this a dot is exactly the same as this epsilon, right? So I just have to read the charge by looking at the term that multiplies. So this would have been a symmetry if a were constant. Now I promote a to be an arbitrary function. And the coefficient of the derivative of the parameter that if a constant had been a symmetry, I can read the charge. So from here I get that q, which is usually called p, because momentum, is x dot. OK? A less obvious, well, it's still obvious, but symmetry is that this should be invariant under Galilean boosts. So invariant under Vt. So now in this case, you get something a bit more interesting. So you get the arbitrary variation is this, right? So all I have to do is compute delta x dot when I promote v to an arbitrary function of time, because I want to read the charge. So from here, I'm going to get something like x dot. B plus B dot T. So I'm allowed to integrate by parts at will. So from here, I'm going to get that I want to plot B dot. So I'm going to get X dot T minus X. Okay. So this means that this quantity is conserved. And this is nothing but the generator of boosts. Okay. So you see this is a very simple way of writing down what the conserved quantity is. And you can just check by using the equations of motion that, of course, this guy is conserved. And also this guy is conserved. But now one interesting that you can check is that, indeed, the Poisson brackets of P and B is actually non-trivial in this case. And is essentially proportional to I. Or if I had put the mass of the particle here, you would have gotten the mass of the particle here. Good. So all, this was all supposed to be extremely elementary, so we're not confused by anything. Okay. Now, something I want to say is that, that in Poincaré invariant, field theories, which we will discuss more later, the fact that you have translations plus Lorentz transformations implies that your theory that exists an energy momentum tensor, which is symmetric. Which is symmetric, that follows from Lorentz invariants, and conserved. Which means that d mu nu equals zero. So every local field theory that is Poincaré invariant has a conserved energy momentum tensor. And this is just another example of Noether's theorem, that you have a current associated to a symmetry. And as usual, in the absence of quantum mechanics, this is an extreme conservation. Okay? Something that will be important is when you study the symmetries of fermions, like the fermions in the standard model. So here we're going to have an action. So let's be in even dimensions. The properties of fermions change drastically between even and odd dimensions. If that is not clear, I can explain why. But let's consider even dimensions. Four dimensions is even in particular. So this action has one obvious symmetry, which is just rephasing of your field psi. Okay. This is called usually U1 vector symmetry. The reason this is called U1 vector symmetry is that psi, okay, so here, yeah, so psi, if you wish, okay, so in even dimensions, the reducible representations of the Lorentz group are chiral spinors. Which have a definite chirality, okay? Okay, so here I may have to, or if this is known, I don't need to talk more about it, but is this known? Essentially, the point is that there are two irreducible representations that are not transformed into each other by the Lorentz group. You have left-moving fermions and right-moving fermions, and they have different charts under Viewis parity, okay? And it's called vector because this transformation acts the same on, say, and if you have a what's called a Dirac spinner, so it's made out of a left-moving, a spinner of left chirality and of right chirality, this transformation acts the same on the two chiralities, okay? And associated to this transformation, you have a conserved current of this type. By the way, these gammas are the Dirac gamma matrices. I assume that people know what this is. If not, you should ask me. Okay, so that's one symmetry. The other symmetry that we have is a chiral symmetry. So this is a symmetry that acts differently on the left chirality spinner and the right chirality spinners. So it acts like as psi goes to I alpha gamma star psi. Okay. So it means that the phase has charge one for the left moving one and charge minus one for the other one. And by Noether's theorem, we have a, usually call it G mu 5, another conserved current, gamma mu, gamma star psi. Okay, and it's conserved, at least classically. Good. So now the question is, okay, this is great, this is classical physics. What if any of this survives quantization? Okay. So now we're gonna, one way to think about it is that this is, in some sense, the strict h bar goes to zero limit. And I want to study whether a symmetry. So the basic question that we want to study is whether. So imagine you have a classical system that has a certain symmetry group G. What you want to study is whether quantization of the system preserves the symmetry G. Okay? And very importantly, it is not always possible to quantize a system and preserve a symmetry G. And this has very important consequences, as I will try to outline. Yeah. Yes?
Is it obvious that these two UI symmetries commute?
They commute.
They commute?
Yes.
Yeah, but is there, so I didn't understand what this gamma star was.
Yeah, so let's, you will like in two dimensions. So gamma star in two dimensions will be 1 minus 1. So, okay, so should I say more or is it clear from this? Okay.
Is gamma star the same as gamma 5?
Sorry? Yes. So I use a star because it's in all even dimensions, but okay. I use 5, okay. But then a star in the kernel might look like complex conjugation, so I don't know. Yeah, so gamma star, okay, so more, yeah, but I didn't really write what it is. So if I'm in even dimensions, if I'm on 2n dimensions, gamma star is actually the product of all gamma matrices. The fundamental property of this gadget is that it anti-commutes with all gamma matrices. So gamma star anti-commutes with all gamma matrices. So this allows you to define a projection on the spinners so that you have two irreducible representations, the left one and the right one. Okay. So let me, essentially, since this will be the main point of at least this kind of informal discussion, is what is an anomaly? I mean, one definition of what an anomaly is a quantum mechanical obstruction of a classical symmetry to survive quantization. So in formulas, what this means, what this word means, is that there can be currents that were classically conserved. So the A mu, J mu equals 0 classically. But when you turn on quantum mechanics, have the property that A mu, J mu is proportional to H bar and different from 0. Okay. So there's one way of saying it at face value, all that this means is that G, okay, so classical symmetry G, this just means that G is not a symmetry of your system. Okay. Okay, so now something I have to go into a little bit is that it makes a big difference what is the nature of the symmetry that is anomalous. So there are actually two cases that we should discuss. So if G is a global symmetry, there's nothing particularly pathological about it. It just means that in the quantum theory, what you thought was a classical symmetry is not a symmetry of your Hilbert space. Okay, but this gives rise to Ritz phenomena. So I'm going to give you just a couple of examples. So the first one is if you study quantum chromodynamics, classically, just like my cookie 1 over x squared potential, classically the theory is a scale invariant. You write the Lagrangian of QCD, there is no scale in the Lagrangian. This is the gauge coupling is dimensionless. So this means that in the classical world, it means that since there is a scale symmetry, there's a conserved current. And the conserved, okay, so a scale transformation is just a transformation that rescales coordinates homogeneously. Now we're in a Poincaré invariant theory, so you rescale time and space in the same way. It means that there is a dilatation current. I already said before that in any Poincaré invariant theory, there is an energy momentum tensor. Okay. Now, all space-time transformations, and this is an example of a space-time transformation, are essentially always constructed from the energy momentum tensor. Okay. So that means that the dilatation current can be constructed by taking the energy momentum tensor and contracting with x nu. Okay. And the statement that you have a mu, that there is a dilatation symmetry, so there is a dilatation current is conserved. In this choice of, you can always choose your current to have this property, implies that the trace of the energy momentum tensor, let me write it maybe this way, is zero. So, or t mu mu equals zero. So you have a certain operator in your theory, the trace of the energy momentum tensor, that if you have a scale symmetry is traceless. Okay. But now, one of the deep, absolutely deep fundamental facts about quantum mechanics and QCD is that QCD acquires, through quantum effects, a dynamical scale, which is the QCD scale. So this theory had no scale, but quantum mechanically generates a scale, which is the QCD scale. So obviously, if you have a scale, the system cannot be scale invariant. So what this means is that if you look at the trace of the energy momentum tensor, the trace of the energy momentum tensor in the quantum theory, what you find is that it's not zero anymore. It's proportional to what's called the beta function, which describes how the coupling of QCD changes with scale times essentially the action trace of f minus square. Okay. So this is an example of an anomaly. You have a classical symmetry that cannot be preserved by quantization. And this is not bad. There's no problem. In fact, this is very good because the fact that you have a scale anomaly, in some sense, it is what's responsible for confinement of quarks. Well, OK, of course, let's say confinement. I didn't put the quarks in. Very good. I should mention, just as a curiosity, is that there are very mundane, very mundane non-relativistic systems that have exactly the same phenomena where you would have a classical scale invariant system, but that quantum mechanically acquires a scale. So again, since I feel I'm talking to myself, I will ask the audience. So let's consider Schrodinger equation. So potential scattering. In two dimensions, which I guess means one plus two dimensions. Again, so what would be the Schrodinger equation? Would be like something like what? Okay, so there is a very, so when you study potential scattering in quantum mechanics, there is a very, the simplest model of a Schrodinger potential that you study in one dimension, which is the delta function potential, so in 1D. We have all studied, say, scattering or bound states through a delta function potential. Now, you can, okay. So now, can someone tell me what's special about the delta function potential? So let me write this. So V of x equals alpha delta of x. So can someone tell me what's special about the delta function potential in two dimensions? So. It has a scale symmetry. Because essentially, again, just like before, if the potential is square the same way as p square, then you have a scale symmetry. And you know, delta has this cookie property that delta of lambda x is 1 over lambda delta x. So in two dimensions, you get 1 over lambda square. So this scales exactly the same way as p square. So that means that this alpha parameter is dimensionless in two dimensions, okay? So that means that classically there is no scale. So you would think that you have a continuous spectrum of scattering states or discrete states. But if you look more carefully at the system, and so I'm not going to do this here because, well, but essentially studying the bound state problem in this system more seriously by, for example, look at the scattering problem or the bound state problem by writing the Lippmann-Schwinger equation. Essentially, this is just the problem of a scattering through a potential. So we have some Hamiltonian, which is the free Hamiltonian, plus the potential. Then textbook quantum mechanics tells you that this can be written as, this plus minus tells you whether you have an outgoing or incoming reflected wave. Times B of psi of pi plus minus. As an exercise, what I ask you to do is that if you study this problem in two dimensions, you will find that the system will also generate quantum mechanically a scale, which is similar to lambda QCD. So even though classically you didn't have a scale, quantum mechanically you have a scale. And actually, in some sense, this theory, this example exhibits asymptotic freedom. Okay, so this is an exercise for next time.
How many bound states do you have?
You have one bound state.
One bound state.
At this energy scale.
So, and then after you express things in terms of the mass of that bound state, the parameter disappears.
Yes, exactly. It's like exactly QCD. I don't know how to use this. I should keep this. Okay. So as we see that for global symmetries, there is no problem in violating the classical symmetry. In fact, the fact that the classical symmetry is violated has deep consequences for the quantum dynamics of your system. Another famous example was early on is the fact that there's a chiral symmetry in QCD that is broken quantum mechanically. And in fact, it's responsible for the main decay channel of the pion into two photons. I know this sounds horribly particle physics, but it's precisely because there is an anomaly that explains this decay channel. So the fact that there are anomalies explains phenomena. It's not bad. It's good. Another thing I should say about anomalies, but this is more theoretical, is the fact that you have anomalies gives you non-perturbative constraints on the dynamics of your theory. So typically, one way we define theories is you give some, you start in the ultraviolet, which means at short distances, and you give some degrees of freedom, and you want to understand what happens in the infrared. So this would be like a QCD, you give quarks and gluons, and you want to know what's happening at large distances, where you have the degrees of freedom of the theory have completely rearranged. So something that Tuft understood very early on, which is very powerful in constraining what possible bits can happen in the infrared. So given a theory in the ultraviolet, the dynamics in the infrared can be extremely complicated. But it, in fact, anomalies, if your theory in the ultraviolet has anomalies, it constrains what kind of bits can appear in the infrared, because there's the idea of Tuft anomaly matching. Which tells you that the anomalies that you had in your short distance theory have to agree with the anomalies in the long distance theory. So for example, this is a useful way of constraining the massless bound states that an anomalous theory can have in the infrared. So this is a kind of with a non-perturbative constraint that the fact that you have anomalies gives you. It's not bad, it's actually extremely good. It allows you to constrain. It allows you to rule out certain potential dynamics that you could have in the infrared just because it violates anomaly matching. Okay, so that's one. So one shouldn't feel depressed that there are anomalies for global symmetries. Okay. Now the other symmetries that we have to worry a bit more. How did I label this? I don't know. So now we want to look at anomalies for gate symmetries. Okay, so this is a horrible name, gate symmetries, but that's what textbooks say. So examples of gate symmetries would be like the gate redundancies that we have in QCD or in electromagnetism or okay, so examples would be like gate transformations in electromagnetism, for example, or diffeomorphism invariant in gravity. So, for example, so these guys have a very different nature than the global symmetries I described before. In a sense, they're not symmetries at all, because what these guys do essentially is give rise to constraints on the Hilbert space of your theory. Essentially, you get Gauss's law constraints. They essentially tell you that your states have to be invariant. So they're not symmetries at all. I mean, it tells you that. So usually, a symmetry means that you can label your state in a representation of your symmetry. While gate symmetries, what they force you to do is that all your states should be invariant under that symmetry. Okay. And the reason that this is extremely important to do is that it's precisely these constraints that eliminate negative norm states that your gauge theory or your gravity theory has. It's precisely because you have gauge symmetries that allows you to remove the unphysical degrees of freedom that would otherwise be propagating in your system. Okay? So these are fundamental for unitarity of the theory. So the fact that you can impose this condition is crucial to eliminate negative norm states. Okay. So this is a serious problem now. So imagine you have a theory that has certain gate symmetry. Classically, if this gate symmetry is anomalous quantum mechanically, this will give to a serious problem, because this will essentially imply that your theory will not be unitary. And for most of us, giving up on unitarity is like giving up on your mother. I mean, it's really not, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. Maybe in the quantum foundation, it's not so bad, I don't know. Not so bad, okay. I'll tell your mother, okay. Okay. So this is actually, so in a sense, this gives you an extremely powerful constraints of what consistent in the sense that you want unitarity, also renormalizability, but that's a weak, I mean, in a sense, a less important criterion. This gives you a serious constraint on what theories could give rise to unitary interactions between particles. And these theories can be anomalous if your theory, so theories that can have potentially gate symmetry, gate anomalies. So gauge anomalies can appear in quantum field theories that violate parity. So let's talk about gauge anomalies, yeah. And a famous example of a theory that violates parity in an absolutely brutal way is the Standard Model, particle physics. So it's actually, I think, probably not emphasized enough how remarkable it is that all anomalies in the Standard Model cancel after you sum over your particle spectrum. So let me just very briefly say this, because I think it's an important point. So there's something called the standard model of particle physics. That has the following local gauge redundancies. So the standard model violates parity. It's based on an SU3 times SU2 times U1 hypercharge gauge symmetry. Electromagnetism appears when the Higgs gets an expectation value and breaks this to U1 electromagnetism. And what you have is three generations of quarks and leptons. So I'll just describe one generation, and then you get three identical copies of it. So essentially, you have the left moving and up and down quarks. They transform into this has 1/6. Then the right moving, so the theory is parity invariant would mean that the left and the right moving guys transform the same way. And you will see that the standard model does absolutely not do that. Sorry, 2/3. So you see that, for example, under SU2 and under U1, left moving fermions and right moving fermions transform, they don't transform in the same way. So this is a parity violating theory. So this is the quark sector. And you have the lepton sector. So there you have the neutrino and the electron left mover, which is a singlet under color. They don't carry any gluon charge. They're a doublet under SU2, and they carry hypercharge -1/2. And then you have the right moving, the right chiral electron, which has this. OK? So you see again that this violates parity in a crucial way. So the condition that you can derive by analyzing your quantum theory in more detail, which I'll explain a little bit now, is that in order for anomalies to cancel, so mu, j mu, so OK, anomalies cancel, if the following condition is satisfied. If you sum over all the spectrum of your theory, you have fermions. You sum over all left-handed fermions, and you take the trace in the representation. So A1, A2, A3 could be any of these factors, okay? Minus, because the contribution from, since they have different chirality and they differ by assigning the chirality, you get a negative contribution from the right moving right chiral fermions. And this is a symmetrized trace, okay? So anomalies cancel if this is true, okay? And this gives actually for the standard model, this is a symmetric tensor with three indices, so there are 10 equations. And you can check, it's a fun exercise to do it once in your life, to check that, for example, for U1Q, okay, so I could choose this to be any generators I like. I can choose the three of them to be U1 hypercharge cubed. This means that if I sum the hypercharge and I plug in this funny number, so the fact there are 6 fermions of hypercharge 1/6, so 1/6 cubed is whatever it is, and you add all these cubes, this always gives you 0. So this is a beautiful example that despite that the standard model is at the edge of death, it survives, even though these numbers are not put by hand for anomaly cancellation. These are numbers that are picked up from experiment. And it's kind of a triumph that indeed the theory is consistent. It cancels all anomalies. But if you had a theory, if you thought you have a theory of nature and your theory does not satisfy anomaly cancellation, well, then you at least have to give up on something that for most of us is secret, like unitarity. Okay.
So by unitarity, you mean the probabilities are possible?
Like, yes.
You don't mean, because unitarity might mean.
So that's all states have positive norm and SS dagger equals 1.
John, I have to comment. You said at some point you said there's unitarity and there's renormalizability, and you said, well, renormalizability is not that important.
That's true.
There was a time when people would have said exactly the same thing about renormalizability, and did say.
Yes, because
you're now saying about unitarity.
Yeah, so if someday there is any evidence, experimental evidence, that unitarity is violated, then we'll worry about that. The issue of renormalizability back then is very different. It was an issue that people did not understand effective field theories well enough and thought that normalizability was a fundamental criterion within, and it's not at all.
That's true, but I think when we come to gravity, we have a similar feeling about unitarity.
Well, so.
One other question.
Yes.
Do you know, I always ask this to people, what are the best experimental bounds on violations of unitarity?
I don't know. Like a unitarity as what? Measured by S dagger n equals one?
Or? One example is an optical theorem, so I think there are some.
Well, I think that, I mean, the, you know, in CERN, they have a cross-section, right? And there must be a way of, you know, you look at all possible things that can happen and all those things should add to one. But I cannot tell you a number. I cannot tell you.
That's a very weak thing. That's just probability conservation.
Yes.
But S dagger equals one is like you said, a much stronger.
I cannot give you a good example, a good bound, I don't know. A very useful way to put up anomalies, whether your theory is anomalous or not, is by looking at the following. So we said that if you have a symmetry, you have a conserved current. And then what you can always do is you can couple your current to a background Gates field. Okay, so what this means in practical terms is that you add the source, a mu, for your current. Okay? So that's is this clear what I mean by that? So essentially, if I do the functional derivative with respect to A, you get the current. Okay? Sometimes you have to, this has to be corrected by order A squared terms, depending on the details. Also for gravity, you want to couple your theory to gravity. What you would do is you would couple your energy momentum tensor to some metric perturbation, and you would have to worry about higher order, not H bar, sorry, H corrections, okay? So now, so the statement of the anomaly now can be phrased that if you can define the partition function of your system to, so I'm gonna use a path integral language, but you don't have to. So you have this thing that is, the measure, this is where all the fun is hidden. And then you have e to the s, say phi means by all your degrees of freedom, and then I have this background connection that measures to the current. The statement that you have a classical symmetry is just a statement that under the transformation d mu alpha, the partition function is invariant. This is totally equivalent to saying that a mu j mu equals zero. Okay. Likewise, if you do a transformation under diffeomorphisms, the invariance of the partition function is the same that the energy momentum tensor is conserved. Okay? So an anomaly can be phrased as, in this language of the partition function, as a statement that the variation, to be precise, should be the log of the partition function, because we're looking at the connected part. Anyway, this is a small detail, don't worry about it. You could put z if you, to this approximation, you could put z, I'm okay with it. This will be non-zero, and will be some local integral of alpha. So alpha is the parameter of the transformation, times some a, where a is some local functional of your fields a mu, okay? So the fact that, and this is totally equivalent, again, to saying that in an operator equation that A mu J mu equals this A. These are just two equivalent ways of saying the same thing. Either you have an operator equation that has a non-zero source, or the partition function as a functional of the background gauge field is not gauge invariant, okay? And roughly speaking, the fact that you have this term, this violation, quantum mechanical violation of the symmetry, comes precisely because for certain symmetries, the measure of the path integral. So in the classical world, in the h-bar goes to zero limit, we could just worry about the invariances of the action. In the quantum world, we have to worry about invariances of the full path integral, which means also in particular the invariances of the measure. The statement of an anomaly is that the measure cannot be met invariant. It's not invariant. And in fact, this local functional of the fields, one way of obtaining it is by very carefully studying how the measure transforms under the putative transformation. Okay. So if you wish, the one take a home message is that when we define the path integral, we have to define this funny symbol, d mu. And it is this guy that is responsible for the violation of the classical symmetry. Because in the quantum world, we cannot ignore the measure. The measure is part of the integral that you're doing. And that also has to be invariant under the symmetry. And one very important consistency condition that this anomaly has to satisfy is just the statement that the partition function has to represent the symmetry. Okay? So that means that if I do the commutator of two transformations, it has to equal the variation of the commutator of the transformations acting on the partition function. Okay. So this is some sort of consistency condition. That your anomaly has to satisfy. Okay. That constrains the form of the anomaly that can appear here. And actually, it is this part that makes also lots of connection with mathematics, because this equation looks a little bit like a cohomology equation. You want to look at things that are close but not exact. And there is a deep connection with that, with cohomology. Okay. Good. One more. So there are essentially just two more statements I want to make. And maybe if I have time, I can give you a very lowbrow way of discovering a very simple anomaly in two dimensions that doesn't need, where you will not need to know about Feynman diagrams and all of that stuff, which I'm not sure to what extent it's familiar. One thing that's remarkable, and it actually has played a very important role recently in condensed matter physics, is that you can have systems that are anomalous. That would be anomalous in isolation. So imagine you have some system here that has an anomaly. But actually, if this system lives at the boundary of some higher dimensional space, the combined system, so bulk plus boundary, is consistent. So one way to make anomalous theory consistent is to couple it to a higher dimensional theory. And this kind of physical mechanism where the violation of the anomaly, so the non-invariance of the partition function that comes from the boundary term is precisely canceled by the bulk term. Okay? And this guy is called anomaly inflow. This kind of physics plays a crucial role in condensed matter, and the buzzwords are SPT phases. So these are systems that would otherwise have been anomalous, but they are consistent if they live at the boundary of a system. of a one higher dimensional system. And the higher dimensional system is a certain topological field theory that under gauge transformations cancels the anomaly induced on the boundary. I mean, the simplest example of this is the quantum Hall system. So here you have, this in 2+1 dimensions. So this theory describes a certain Chern-Simons theory. So in 2+1, you would have some, I'm being a bit schematic here, but okay. And on the boundary of this system, you have a chiral fermion, which means that it's a fermion that only has one chirality. So it's only left moving or right moving, okay? But from anomaly cancellation, we know that this guy will give rise to an anomaly if because there is no way to cancel the contribution from the left-handed fermion. But what happens is that the delta alpha of z of the fermion, which is actually, you can compute this, okay, is precisely canceled by the variation under the gauge transformation. So now this Chern-Simons theory lives in a space with a boundary, okay? And the Chern-Simons theory is not invariant under gauge transformations if the space has a boundary. In fact, what you get is something like under a gauge transformation, you get alpha f, something like that. And these two guys exactly cancel, okay? So you made the system consistent by coupling your anomalous system to one dimension higher. And this is, like there are thousands of papers written on this stuff in condensed matter physics. Good. Can I take like 3 minutes just to, oh, you're the chair, yes? So now I just want to give you a very, in a sense, trivial way of saying that you encountered an anomaly without doing Feynman diagrams or anything. So, and since maybe not everyone is very familiar with fermions, I'll take an example of an anomaly that also happens with theories with scalars. So let's consider a 1+1 dimensional field theory, Poincaré invariant field theory that has a conformal symmetry. Okay, so that means that classically the trace of the energy momentum tensor is zero, okay? Now we want to study whether quantum mechanical this statement is correct or not, okay? So one very low bar, I mean, there are many ways of attacking this problem, but one very low bar way to do it is the following. So we're going to, so there is this equation that comes from conformal invariance, and then there is this other equation that comes from Poincaré invariance, okay? So now we want to study the following, so in quantum field theory, we usually study correlation functions of operators. So in particular, one of the things I want to study is the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor. I'm going to do it in momentum space, just because it's a bit simpler. So I write the most general two-point function of the energy momentum tensor that is consistent with like elementary principles like Lorentz invariance, and importantly, conservation law. Conservation of, I mean, we don't want to give up on this. We can give up on this actually in two dimensions. We can have what's called gravitational anomalies in two dimensions, but for the time being, let's just impose that these correlations, these correlation functions obey conservation, okay? So then all that you have to do is writing, so you have momentum P and you have the metric, you can write down the most general thing that you can write on the right-hand side. There are 5 terms. So this could also be an exercise. And now you impose a conservation, okay? This reduces this to 2 structures that are consistent. So conservation means that essentially that if I, after conservation, which means that P mu acting on the correlation function has to vanish. That's what conservation means in momentum space. And a little miracle in two dimensions is that Actually, so this part could be done in arbitrary dimensions. One thing that is special about two dimensions is that actually only one of the structures survives. Essentially, you could think of the structure that you get is as a spin two part and a spin zero part. Only the spin zero part survives, so, which can be written in the following way. So this is, again, an elementary exercise. And a convenient way of writing this is the following. So I can define okay, where this P tilde. So in two dimensions, we have the, I think it's called a bit beta, the epsilon tensor. Let me call it lambda, P lambda. Okay. The reason this is useful of writing it this way is that it makes manifest that if I contract P with any index of this type, it will vanish. So that this makes manifest that we have momentum, energy momentum conservation explicitly, just because P mu, P tilde mu is zero, okay? So if I contract with any P that I like, you get zero, okay? Now, I said that we're in a conformal field theory, so, and T has a certain dimension. The dimension of the energy momentum tensor in two dimensions is two, but here I'm looking at the Fourier transform of it, so it has dimension zero, so after some trivial dimensional analysis, it means that dimensional analysis tells you that this guy has to be of this type. Okay? And all that's undetermined is this coefficient C. Okay? So this is the most general form allowed by energy momentum conservation of the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor. Okay? I could Fourier transform back to position space, and you could measure this coefficient C by looking at the energy momentum tensor at two separated points, say. But now we see that there is a funny obstruction to preserving the tracelessness of the energy momentum tensor. Why? So now let me take the trace. So classically, the trace was zero, right? Now let me take the trace of this guy. I get the T mu mu, T rho sigma. So I just have to contract this with eta mu nu. And now I just use the fact that it's proportional to P squared. Okay? Epsilon squared essentially is the identity. So this cancels this non-analytic part of the two-point function. 1 over P squared, if you Fourier transform into position space, has support at separated points. So it cancels this part, and all that you get is this simple P rho P sigma times C. Okay. But notice that this is very funny. The right-hand side here is a polynomial in momentum, which means that if I Fourier transform to position space, so let me write this in, it's just a Fourier transform of P squared, essentially it's a derivative of a delta function, right? So okay, so if I want to be pedantic about it, I guess I will have to write it. So I get d rho d sigma minus eta rho sigma. So this is a correlator that has only support at coincident points. If x is differs from zero, you get zero, but at the coincidence point, you get this is called a contact term. But the fact that you can have this contact term is precisely what gives rise, as I will show now in a second, to the statement that quantum mechanically, T mu mu is not zero. Okay. Now, you could have said, well, why don't you put C equals zero and get it over with? But you can't, because C equals zero would mean that the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor at separated points would vanish. And that's inconsistent with unitarity again. Sorry, Lafayette. So there is an irrevocable anomaly that you get that cannot be gotten rid of. Okay? And another way to think about this in terms of the language I said before of coupling to background fields, now you could study the effect of this contact term Once you couple your theory to background metric, so I can now consider coupling my theory to a metric perturbation. So I have now Z as a function of H.
I have something basic.
Yes.
Here, as I mentioned, in momentum space and momentum
at
dimension 0.
Yes. So the reason you're confused is that here there is a delta 2.
Okay. Delta 0.
Yes. I knew you would get confused about that. You're not the only one that has gotten confused about that. Okay. Now, what I want to compute now is the trace of the energy momentum tensor in the presence of coupling to a background metric. So what is this? The term that contributes, because the one-point function of the energy momentum tensor is always vanishes in a CFT. What you have is essentially bringing down this guy. So this would be T mu mu. Not to confuse you, let me write this. Okay. Essentially, what you get is dx T mu mu say at zero T rho sigma at x. H rho sigma, okay? So now I just put in this thing here. And I can act this differential operator on the metric, right? I mean, I can just integrate by parts so that, okay, so this is G rho d sigma minus box eta rho sigma delta 2 of x acting on H rho sigma. I can just integrate by parts and hit here. And what this tells you is that T mu mu at zero is C times something that maybe you recognize. So notice now that the right-hand side is even at separated points in the presence of a metric is non-zero. Okay? And this guy, what is this guy? Well, this is nothing but the linearization of the Ricci scalar around flat space to leading order. Okay. So these are, I think, a very elementary way of saying that the fact that you have a conformal anomaly is, in a sense, inevitable if you impose conservation of the energy momentum tensor. And in fact, in a unitary theory, this gadget has to be non-zero, positive. I noticed that we derived this without ever having to resort to Feynman diagrams or anything like that. This was just using conservation laws and motherhood and apple pie principles like that. Since I'm way over time, I think I'll stop. Thank you for your attention. Yeah.
So in quantum foundations, there's this tradition of looking, trying to find the essentially quantum features.
Yes.
And things like
that's why I'm here, I think.
Exactly.
Yes.
And there's things like, you know, entanglement and violation of Bell inequalities, or interference or contextuality and so on. And this is this. I'm not aware of anyone in the foundations community thinking about anomalies or considering
yes.
what is essentially quantum about them. But you would assert this is something that's essentially quantum and non-classical. You can't have this kind of phenomenon in classical. I suppose you can't, which is a good way to find it.
Yes. I'm not aware of an analogous phenomena that can be modeled by a classical system.
Right.
So, I mean, that's why, in a sense, we're having this
yeah.
seminar, because maybe there is a clever way of modeling this by some classical system, but this seems to be a truly quantum mechanical phenomenon.
Well, statistical mechanics, you could have something similar, no?
Like what?
No, I'm saying if the formalism of statistical mechanics could be if you also have to integrate all the configurations with
yes.
Boltzmann weights. I mean, the formalism is the Euclidean. You could think that it's Euclidean version.
Yes.
And so maybe you could have an anomaly there if the measure, again,
well, the formalism is really very similar to this. So, what would be the small parameter there?
Oh, I have no idea.
I mean, here h bar is the one that makes the discontinuous change from being zero to non-zero. Maybe the temp. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, but maybe. Yes.
You didn't really emphasize the role of regularization.
Yes, because I yes, no, that's a good point. Yes, I didn't.
Because one normally reads that anomalies arise because the regularization doesn't commute with or is inconsistent with
the... Does not preserve the symmetry, yes.
Yes, with the...
Yeah, so that, I could have said that. That I feel is a bit misses the point of the anomaly, because first of all, I'm not 100% sure that one cannot cook up examples where this is not an issue. In fact, I think in this SPT faces world, you could construct discrete anomalies. You can consider discrete anomalies in manifestly finite systems with a finite number of states. But the reason I don't like this point of view so much is that it makes you think that it has to do only with certain deep ultraviolet short distance physics. Well, the point I was trying to make here is that first of all, the anomaly is something that you can make a low energy observer, absolutely low energy observer, would measure. In a sense, it has nothing to do with short distance physics. It's something that you can measure at long distances. Now, technically, there is kind of an ultraviolet infrared kind of mixing. And in the usual description that you find in textbooks, you would say that, yeah, it has to do with the fact, okay, raise it, that the measure cannot be the theory cannot be regularized while preserving all the symmetries. But that, I think, misses the point that it has long distance effects. It has very, very little to do with, usually we think of short distance things as some garbage that different people regularize things in different ways, but have no inherent universal meaning. Well, anomalies definitely have, any person that regularizes in different ways will agree that there is an anomaly. It's not that someday someone will come with a better regularization and get rid of the anomaly. This is definitely not the point. So for like zeroth order introduction, I don't want to use that point because it might confuse what the physics of the anomaly is, which is really associated to long distance physics. But I agree technically that it has to do with, in most examples, it has to do with the inability to regulate while preserving all symmetries. Yes.
So I want to go back to your simple example of the 2D Dirac potential.
Okay, yeah.
So one thing I didn't understand was you said that when you quantize that problem, a scale emerges.
Yes.
And that seems like a dimensionful quantity that has to merge, but the inputs to the problem are this symmetric action. So how could a dimensionful scale
merge? It's exactly the same. You could have said the same thing about QCD.
Okay, and so what's
the answer? The answer is that, again, this has to do with regularization, that in order to really make sense of the problem, you have to introduce a fiducial scale, like if you use an ultraviolet cutoff, that's the those bad words that you use. But then, at the end of the day, you can what's called renormalize the theory and introduce, if you use a true physical dynamical scale into the theory, and replace the fact that you had one parameter that was dimensionless lambda by a physical dynamical scale. And so the reason that this arises technically, you're saying where does these short distance things come from is the following. Okay, I was gonna collect the exercise next week, but I'll do it in the blackboard. Okay. Well, let me see if I can do it. So we're solving this problem, right? So we have h equals h naught p squared plus. Okay, forget about the sign. If it's attractive or repulsive, that's not very important. And this is alpha delta to right, okay? So let's look at the wave function as a function of x. So I start with an incoming wave with energy k squared over 2. And I'm just solving the scattering problem, okay? So here, what I'm gonna get is, okay, so, I'll write something, and if you want, I'm skipping one step. I can go back to it if you want. So this will give you alpha to alpha.
Maybe you misunderstood my question. So I am not asking to see a proof of anything. I'm really asking more. What is the final scale that emerges, and how can I sort of see it in the statement of the problem? That's sort of what I'm concerned. It seems like there's something in the output of the problem, which is dimensional.
Yeah, because the reason is that in finding the spectrum of the problem, you realize that secretly you have to introduce a scale to define it.
Oh, okay. So that's,
because you essentially have to do this integral. sorry, b squared. Okay. Now, in order to quantize the spectrum, you can solve this equation by putting x equals 0. Okay. That's usually, you can solve the one-dimensional delta function potential in exactly the same way, and you get the energy spectrum, the bound state spectrum. But in that case, you would have just dp here, and this would be a perfectly finite integral. But notice that this integral has a logarithmic divergence. Okay. So in order to really define the problem, you have to introduce some hard cutoff. And then through the magical normalization, you introduce this cutoff, and then you solve for the scattering problem. So now you ask, what does the wave function look very far away? And essentially, from that, you can read the scattering matrix. And what you find is that the scattering matrix has a pole. So maybe is this enough, or why this scale appears is because the need to define what you mean by this at short distances. But the key point again with the whole subject is that this scale is traded off by an infrared scale. Just like in QCD, you have a short distance scale, but at the end of the day, what you speed up is the QCD scale, which is some low energy scale. Here is exactly the same. You define the theory by introducing a UV regulator, but what you do is you trade off the UV regulator by an infrared scale, which is precisely the energy of the single bound state that you get in this problem. It's kind of a lambda QCD kind of scale. So even though you introduce a short distance scale, it has long distance implications. Yes?
Yeah, I wonder if there isn't a way of doing this in the way that you would like, I think, without ever introducing a cutoff or any direct reference to UV. So I haven't done it. I don't know this problem very well. I mean, I haven't studied this problem, but it looks like a problem of self-adjoint extension.
Yeah.
So you wrote down this operator in the Schrodinger equation.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, it's not essentially what's called essentially self-adjoint.
Yes, but I think that just passes the problem of what's the choice of self-adjoint extension that you choose.
Right. So the idea. So presumably one would prove that there is a whole one parameter set of self-adjoint extensions, but none of them are scale invariant.
Yes, I think that's
the choice of that.
I think that's an
acute extension would be
yes.
The choice of scale. It wouldn't give a deep answer.
I think
why that scale emerged.
I think that's the is definitely correct. I think yes. But yeah.
If one studied how that happened, you might see.
This may have been done. I don't really know. Actually, I don't know much about this.
I mean,
when preparing with this, I thought about it. Yeah.
You might see then why scale came in. I'm not sure that it would that in the end one would be more enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
It seems possible.
You said at some point that the anomalies occur because of the measure in the parking film not being invariant.
Yes.
Can you relate that to this particular
problem? Well, so that's a bit trickier. So the relation with the measure is more. So here was a bit. There are two essentially different types of anomalies.
Okay,
one.
So this is a different kind of anomaly. This is the global.
No. What I was saying is that here the anomaly, like the trace anomaly that I described for QCD, the anomalies that really arise naturally from the measure are the ones that where the trace anomaly. So where d mu j mu is just background fields, an extension that only uses the background fields. Like, for example, in the example I just gave you, d mu mu was proportional to the Ricci's curvature. Here, what you get depends on the actual operator of the theory. So it's a slightly different in nature. And this one, I mean, I don't know in what sense. I mean, I don't know precisely how you would get it out of the measure. You get it from some kind of Feynman diagram computation. Maybe there is a way of, I cannot think right now whether there is a way of getting it directly from the measure. But it's a bit different than these ones where definitely it comes from the measure.
Is there no more questions? Let's thank John again.
Thank you.